SBS Radio. Profesor Avni Sali, AMA, një nga pionerët dhe baba i mjekësisë integrative në Australi, është shembulli tipik i ëndrrës australiane. Djali i një emigranti shqiptar të ardhur në Australi në fillimet e shekullit të kaluar, ai pati guximin dhe ambicien të studionte për mjekësi. Kjo dëshirë për të bërë mjek e shtyu që më pas të bëhej edhe një prej kirurgëve më të suksesshëm në vend. Por ëndra e tij nuk mjaftoi me kaq. Pjesë armatës së mjekëve të edukuar me konceptet e mjekësisë perëndimore, profesor Sali ndjente se diçka nuk shkonte. Në një botë ku kura për pacientët, studimet për një sëmundje dhe diagnozat e tyre diktohen nga kompanitë e medikamenteve mjekësore, një mjek shqiptar guxoi të mendonte ndryshe. Profesor Avni Sali ja ka kushtuar jetën dhe karrierën e tij zhvillimit dhe përkrajes së koncepteve të mjekësisë integrative në Australi. Përgjatë një udhëtimi që synon ndryshimin e një sistemi të tërë mjekësor, që tani për tani bazohet në trajtimin e një sëmundjeje nëpërmjet mënyrave dhe medikamenteve tradicionale, profesor Avni Sali ka sjell një frym të re në mënyrën se si duhet të kurohet një sëmundje. Ai thotë se mënyra më e mirë është fokusi në mënyrën se si ushqehemi, si ushtrohemi, prania e familjes dhe miqve në jetën tonë, eliminimi i stresit dhe një mendje shëndosh. Ne patëm nderin që ta kishim në studio profesor Avni Salin dhe biseduam me të rreth historisë jetës së tij, punës dhe planeve për të ardhmen.
Professor Sali, welcome to SBS.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, I will start with your visit to Albania. You have recently been in Albania. We had, a very fortunate meeting over there.
I was, yes, I was very recently over there, and it was a very big surprise to meet you there. I was invited as a keynote speaker and representative of Australia to the European Integrative Medicine Conference, which was in Barcelona. And that's a wonderful thing in order to be able to, in a way, represent Australia in this new area of medicine. But then, because I was going to the conference, and I decided that I'd also call into Tirana, and had not been there for 3 years, and a wonderful surprise again to see the progress that has been made there, even in 3 years.
In what way?
I think it's right at the very beginning, and I went there in the early 90s. I went there before the 90s too, of course, to make a comparison. But there's a degree of sophistication developing, you see, and you have to walk down the street and you notice, bicycle paths and special bicycle paths. They're not only marked, but they've also got I don't know what you call them, but so that the cars can't run into that area, they virtually have got humps, which we don't have here in Australia. So you can see that happening, and of course they need that as well.
Baba i profesor Salit erdhi në Australi në vitin 1928. Ai fillimisht punoi në Australinë Perëndimore, më pas u vendos në zonën e Shepparton në Victoria, një zonë ku ishin vendosur edhe shqiptarë të tjerë dhe ishin krijuar shumë ferma me fruta dhe perime. Në vitin 1934, ai u kthye në Shqipëri për të marrë familjen e pas shumë peripecive arriti të kthehej me ta përsëri në Australi.
You obviously have an Albanian heritage. How did the family come about? How did they come to Australia?
Well, look, it was really difficult to get any information about Albanian history because, of course, it was under very strict communist control during the time when I was growing up. And I must say that what I missed at the time, I never had the opportunity to have grandparents or uncles or aunts, and I knew that people surrounding me had these people. My father came out here when he was about 20, because it was in 1928, and there was the turmoil. Albania was a colony of the Ottoman Empire until the First World War. And then between the First World War and Second World War was this absolute turmoil in Albania. And it was so in a number of other countries, but probably worse in Albania because it had been a colony for nearly 500 years. And so he came out here 28. You couldn't pick a worse time because that was the beginning of the Depression. Mm-hmm. So they worked outside Perth, about 200 kilometres out from Perth, at a place called Wagen, and they were cleaning scrub in order to make it possible to have sheep farming and wheat growing in that area. And that's the only job he could get anyhow, living in a tent 200 kilometres away from Perth, and because there was no work either, you see, with the Depression coming on. And so eventually he was out with two or three cousins. They're amongst the first people. There were some people that came just a bit earlier than that to Australia from Albania. And the other thing is most of them would have liked to go to the US because it was closer. But there was a lottery system. And if your number came up, you could go to the US. Now, I'll give you a guess or two as to how your number came up in those days. Well, there was a little bit of corruption involved. And if you paid behind the scenes, your number was likely to come up. And so you could call it good fortune in some ways that his number never came up. But they moved to the Shepparton area, and they heard that there was possibilities and there were some similarities to what they'd had in Albania, in vegetable growing in particular, but also fruit growing. And then my father had got married before he left, and my eldest brother had been born. So he went back in 1934 to bring them back. But however, the family home had been destroyed by earthquake, so he had to spend the money that he had to pay for the fares to bring my mother and my eldest brother back to build the home. And then he was in a difficult situation that he didn't have the money to come back. Luckily, he was able to organise a loan with cousins from here, and he left in 1937, which was just in time. I mean, when we're looking at human history, the madness of the Second World War, 70 million people being killed. I say to people that the single most defining word of the history of humanity is killing. 20 million in the First World War, and even now hundreds of thousands, and most of the economies of the world orientated around having wars. That's why we'd love to have a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They've got both have got oil, both have got money, and one would buy from Vladimir Putin, and the other one would buy from Trumpy. Makes them popular as well. So, you know, these are the sort of things that we need to expose and educate the public so that they know what's going on. And that's happening, of course, and that's something which is very reassuring, and that's how we improve. But however, you know, 1937 they came back, and they came back to Shepparton. And that's been quite a journey.
Përkrahas jetës tradicionale shqiptare, ku individi rrethohet me miq dhe të afërm, kur takohet me ta rregullisht, profesor Sali thotë se izolimi dhe vetmia në qytetet përbindësh, siç i quan ai, janë shkaqet kryesore të sëmundjeve fizike dhe atyre mendore. Një parim që ai e zbaton edhe në jetën personale. Ai më tej shpjegon edhe ushqimet më të shëndetshme: çokoladë e zezë, ushqimet e detit dhe vaji ullirit.
I had five brothers, and we grew up in the tomato patch, I call it. We had the veggie growing, and we worked very hard. We worked after school, worked on weekends, but there were a lot of good things. I mean, we had cousins nearby that lived in walking distance, and I was talking to you before the interview about distance. The Harvard University, regarded by many as the number one university in the world, about 10 years ago published research work to show where do you get the most support from friends and relatives. It's when they live within a mile. It was a US study, and a mile is 1.67 kilometres, but more importantly, it's walking distance. Mm. And it's really become very clear to me that if you can walk, you will see. That's why car cities, as unfortunately we have here in Australia, are monsters. They isolate people. And the other thing is, we've got the British culture here now, which has been very well recognised. Britain, Australia, US in particular, Canada less so because of the influence of the French, which is quite influential throughout the country. I mean, it's bilingual too, that country. But they still have the British culture, but less so. And the British culture is probably one of the most isolated cultures that exists. And this is in particular bad in the car cities of Australia and the US. In the US, we've seen over the last 3 years life expectancy going down. One of the first countries of developed countries in the world where that is happening. And the main factor is loneliness and isolation, which is a key factor leading to illness and death. Loneliness and isolation. And I was very impressed by the former British Prime Minister, Theresa May, whom I regard as one of the best Prime Ministers they've ever had, where in March of last year she appointed the world's first Minister for Loneliness, recognising the problem and doing something about it, which is what politicians almost never do, doing something about fixing a problem. And that was a wonderful thing to do, you see. Now, loneliness and isolation is even less so in Britain because they don't have the monster car cities. You see, if you've got a relative or friend who lives in Craigieburn and you live in Mount Liza, well, you're hardly ever going to see these people. I have this practicality in my own family. I've got a granddaughter who's 700 metres away. Grandson, I should say, three-year-old, and I've got a granddaughter who's 1 year old, and it's her birthday party this afternoon, and they live 4 or 5 kilometres away. I see the grandson virtually every day. I see the granddaughter most frequently once a week, but usually every 2 weeks even. Mm. Distance isolates, and if people think a car or a helicopter is going to connect them, it really doesn't from a practical point of view. And so the Albanian culture, of course, one of the most closest cultures of all. I used to notice this even when I was a school kid to find that people didn't even know who their close relative was. Whereas in the Albanian community is two things. One is Mediterranean, and all the Mediterranean places are close. Because guess who lives the longest in Europe? I can tell you, I'll give you a clue. That if they're not living the longest, they'll be the second or the third longest in the whole of Europe. They eat white bread, white pasta, a dangerous sausage, and no yogurt. Now, that's a bad diet. Many people regard it as Mediterranean, but they don't know what they're talking about. They see some people eating some salad and fish and they think that's what the Mediterranean eat, but the Italians, that's what they eat. They generally live the longest in Europe. And their biggest thing is, they come of things. They're expressive. They don't keep things in. In our medicine that we've helped introduce in the world, integrative medicine, a key factor is as to who you are and whether you've got backup and what you do with your problems. And the other thing is, when I'm giving a nutrition talk, I'll show a PowerPoint and I'll say, here's the Mediterranean diet. I show Mama and Papa from Italy and 20 family members. I say, that's the Mediterranean diet. I do put a bottle of olive oil there. Mm-hmm. I can quickly summarise the foods too. Number one food is dark chocolate, the cocoa. It's profoundly good for everything. It's the most powerful anti-aging substance on earth. Number two is fish, seafood. And number three is olive oil. They're my top three. And so we've dealt with nutrition. We've dealt with the behavioural. You want someone close to be able to talk with, and you need backup. They're the two most important things for people, to have someone that you can get together with, to have a chat, your close friend. But unfortunately, if they live more than a mile away, which is 1.6 kilometres, more than walking distance,
Well, you've just described the typical Albanian life in Dandenong.
Exactly, yes, that's right. Well, that's why they find it very comfortable there. And it's good to see that so many of them are doing quite well there. The local 24-hour flower shop, I found out, has been Albanian-owned now for about 2 years. And they're actually very active with a few veggie farms and that.
They do, and they support each other to a very high level as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah, that's really good to see.
Was it like that back in Shepparton when you were growing up?
In Shepparton, it certainly was. I mean, look, the Albanian community in Shepparton is a model community for not only Australia, for any place in the world, for togetherness, support, and as a consequence, they've had the least problems to do with behavioural, criminal activity, drugs, etc., because predominantly the togetherness, the backup, and which is so important.
Now, you grew up speaking Albanian, of course, like every other migrant child.
I grew up speaking Albanian, and I could speak to you about tomatoes, peas and peas all day. But when I go to Albania, on this occasion, I was meeting the health minister, as I did last time too. Unfortunately, with them, I have to speak in English because beyond tomatoes and beans and peas, it becomes a bit difficult.
Profesor Sali dëshiron të bëjë mjek që në vogli dhe thotë se ndikimin kryesor në këtë vendim e pati mësuesi ati në shkollën filore. A i tregon për ne edhe momentin e parë në klasën e anatomisë në fakultetin e mjekësisë, rukëtimin e ti drejt kësaj fushe që nuk ka qenë lehtë, për kundrazi, plot me sfida dhe prova që kërkonin këmbgulje dhe besim tek vetja. Të jesh ndryshe nuk është e lehtë, thotë ai, por nëse dëshiron të sjellësh ndryshim, duhet të jesh ndryshe.
So a country boy grows up in a farm and all of a sudden he becomes a doctor. What happened?
Look, I wanted to become a doctor since I was in grade 3. Mm-hmm. And if you ask me why, well, look, there could be all sorts of possibilities. Mm-hmm. Our family doctor had the biggest house in Shepparton, and I have to mention that. Even though I didn't become a private practitioner as such, I've been an academic with some private practice. I was in hospital, though, when I was about 4, and I was isolated. Those days, I isolated people for stupid reasons. I don't know what I had either. But my parents could come in and see me, I think. And that could have been an important factor as well. But then there could have been other factors because... I remember my grade 4 teacher. I was just so fortunate that my grade 4 teacher was her first job, Grahamvale Primary, which is near Grahamvale, well, near Shepparton, 4 or 5 kilometres out of Shepparton, in the midst of the orchards out there. And she asked all of us, what do you want to become? And I said, I want to become a doctor, not realising, of course, that becoming a doctor was not something that you could do very easily. I just... thought at the time I'd like to become a doctor. And she was exceptionally good because she actually, following that, she went through what I needed to do. You know, those days you had to do 3 years at the university and then 3 years in the hospital. That's changed quite a bit since then. And she either didn't know and certainly didn't tell me that in my second year at the university, I had to be dissecting dead bodies. That could have put me off if I had known. I didn't find out about that until first year of medicine. And I was dreading coming back, you know, about the worry. And sure enough, the insensitivity. You see, we're getting better in those areas, but we still need to improve so much. There we are, and they let us loose in a room with about 15, 20 dead bodies, having not seen one ever. I always remember that occasion, and in particular when our doctor, demonstrator they called them, was pointing out some of the surface markings, like there's a bone behind the ear here, the mastoid process, they call it, and he was feeling the dead body, and then I was trying to feel, and then he put his fingers on me, and we didn't wear gloves those days. I couldn't wait to get home for wash, I can tell you. So, but it was... In my Form 2, second year at Shepparton High School, Shep High as we called it, our form teacher, and I moved up to the illustrious position of form captain, mind you, he asked us, what do you want to become? And I said, I want to become a doctor. He said, young Sali, he said, you can't become a doctor. I mean, do you think I'd forget that? Do you think, I'm at home, we didn't even have the newspaper. Why would you have the newspaper? Firstly, you had no time to read it. And secondly, you had to pay for it. So we had nothing to read. And then when this fellow says to me, you can't become a doctor, I'll tell you, that didn't disappear out of my mind very easily. And in many ways, he was probably right. Because in Shepparton, half of the teachers didn't even have a qualification to be teachers. And almost no one ever became a doctor from Shep High, let alone coming from a tomato patch. And he is basically nearly right. And this is an experience that, of course, has played a big part in the way I see the educational problems in this country, that I didn't get into medicine. And I did a year of agricultural science, you see, and I was probably very well equipped for that too with all my personal experience. But then Monash opened, thank goodness, and the dean there was a wonderful person. He came from the real establishment. You see, establishment people, in my experience, generally keep on doing more of the same, but occasionally there can be someone that can actually make changes because of their position of power. And he did, you see, and the first one was that he interviewed everyone that was going to go into medicine, and he thought, oh, that tomato picker from Shepparton can't do much harm. And I'd have to say that Rod Andrew, it was the dean, that I'd never let him down, because in my final year I performed exceptionally well. But more importantly is that to become a world leader in an area of medicine and yet you can't get into medicine, there's something dreadfully wrong with that. And the business of selecting 100 percenters, where we've got secondary schools mainly orientating them and making sausage factories to get a number. Now, I've learned from my experience, who gets the 100 percenter?
Të flasësh me profesor Salin është përvojësore. Ai mban brenda vetes një pasuri diesh dhe mendimesh që e bëjnë edhe një nga specialistët më të përgatitur në fushën e mjekësisë australiane. Por ajo që e karakterizon është moria ideve të reja, mendimeve të përparuara dhe kurajoja për t'i thënë gjërat hapur. Ai flet me pasion, plot humor dhe zëri ëmbël të mbetet në kujtesë, njësoj si dhe mësimet që t'ka dhënë.
This particular phrase didn't come from me. I was visiting the Witten Medical School, which is 80 kilometres out of Düsseldorf in Germany, about 25 years ago, because of my interest. They said that this was a unique medical school. It was set by the Steiner people. I haven't got time to speak about Steiner, but Rudolf Steiner was a wonderful person, a real revolutionary in his time. But the dean of medicine there met me with these words. He said, we don't select medical students like you do by the number of times I read the telephone book. And I immediately knew, because I was into the same wavelength, the telephone book is the VCE notes. Read it 10 times if you don't have that part of the brain that distracts you, you see. And you're quite happy to sit in the desk and read it 10 times. And unfortunately, you know, only about 5% of medical graduates have got that anatomy of the brain that allows them to see other possibilities. And sure enough, coming from migrant background, coming from the tomato patch, my brain was a bit different. I think I was a bit different too. I mean, not just everyone from that environment will be the same. And I did see things a bit different, and I was a bit different at school. And of course, you know, being different is not something which is encouraged. And yet, as a friend of mine says, the only people that have made a difference are those people that are different. It makes a lot of sense.
Well said.
And I think it's a dreadful business that if you're different, and in particular if you've got that part of the brain that can distract you away from the telephone book where you're not going to get 100%, you can't get into medicine. Mm. It's dreadful. We need to make major changes in that area. Most developed countries have, but we haven't. For example, Finland, number one in the world for education in general, they actually banned homework years ago. And they did it for a number of reasons, but the first and most important reason is education is too important to send home to mere amateurs. Education, their teachers have got the highest social status, above doctors and lawyers. They have all got postgraduate qualifications and they're the brightest students. Compared to Australia, the people who get the lowest results get channeled into, not that I'm saying that these results mean much, of course, get channeled into teaching. And so it's got no status here. And it's dreadful. And homework, they banned it, of course, because that's the most important reason. But children have got other more important things, like talking to their their parents, like learning how to grow veggies, like learning a musical instrument or doing a sporting thing. They're more important in many ways than the sort of things that they would be doing for so-called homework. And yet all we can think of in this country is to have bigger homework bags. And that's dreadful. And I see this as the end result in medicine. You see that in general, we could do better by selecting in a different way.
Edhe pse I lindur në Australi, profesor Sali thot se një nga pasionet e tij është historia e popullit shqiptar. Ai thot se Skënderbeu është simboli I liderit të vërtet, dhe në fakt është dhe figura kryesore që e frymëzon profesorin Sali.
I was so desperate to learn about Albanian history Unfortunately, it was virtually impossible to get any because Albania was so isolated and all the people were imprisoned there with communism. But I did find information, and one of the best sources was a book by Edwin Jarks called The Albanians. Now, I think he's from Princeton University. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't an Albanian, he wasn't a Greek or a Serb, and he wasn't a Turk. So you're more likely to get a balance.
A bit of objectivity
there. Yes. So I learned a lot from there. I learned a lot from the Ottoman Empire. I took the boys from the colonies. Very smart move. Made the colony weak and brought up those boys to be in their Ottoman army. A very, very good principle if you want to run a powerful empire. And no one in the colonies to object or to rebel. Unfortunately, women couldn't do the heavy lifting because there was no cranes those days. It had to be done by the blokes and their big muscles. And so we had one of these was Giorgio Castriotti, called Skanderbeg, is his folk hero name. By about 25, 26, he'd become a brilliant general. And he'd been taken from Albania. And he decided with a group of Albanians that when they were fighting, I can't remember which country it was in Europe, but they were fighting quite a lot of countries.
Hungary,
yes. I think it was Hungary. That we'll go and take Albania, which they did, you see, because there's very little resistance. They didn't expect anyone. When the Ottomans found out about this, they're clearly not very happy, so they sent off a small army to teach these people a lesson. Unfortunately, it didn't work. They got defeated over numerous times, and by 2 years, it was the bulk of the Ottoman army of about 200,000, as estimated by Edwin Jarks. And by this time, Giorgio Castriotti had put together about 17,000. He did get support from Venice in particular. There's no such thing as Italy those times. He did get some support. And he was able to repel and defeat the Ottoman army and armies for all the time that he was alive. See, I use him as a perfect example of what a leader should be. His interest was not the empire, was not the greed. And to have it in the 1400s, his main interest was the freedom of his country. And the other remarkable thing is that his sister ran the south and he ran the north, 1400s. Ever since then, I think the Turks taught the Albanians bad habits. But we were into the equality of males, females. It wasn't even a question. That was a remarkable thing. And the Turks didn't take over until he died of malaria 25 years later. I was very impressed one day when I was walking through Rome and I see Via Skanderbeg in order to acknowledge the support that Italy got. And in fact, he also played a big part in the Ottomans not taking it, what became Italy eventually. But that's I see him as one of the best leaders the earth has ever had. A person who's actually had the interests of his country and the people rather than himself.
And certainly a national hero for us. And one of your four heroes, I believe, personal heroes?
My top hero.
Top hero? He's your top hero.
He is, yes.
And, of course, there was Rod Andrew, who played
Rod Andrew, the Dean of Medicine, yes, of course.
Role.
Look, I didn't realise how good he was, and I met him informally in his 80s, you see. And I said to myself, geez, pity I missed out on all this time of being able to be able to learn from this person. He was the first to introduce psychology teaching to a medical school in the mm-hmm. second year, and people started talking, what sort of doctors, you know, they're going to miss out on their anatomy. I mean, some of human thickies. I must say that in general, things get better. I was taught, I had to learn about all these little muscles in the hand that 3 weeks after the exam, I couldn't remember any of them, thank goodness.
Dhe padashur kalojmë në pasionin e tij, mjeksin integrative. Përse së muret një njëri? Është gabim, thot ai, që të përqëndrohesh vetëm tek diagnoza dhe kura. Një sëmundje shkaktohet nga disa faktorë, dhe detyra e një mjeku është që në fillim të zbuloj pikërisht ato aspekte të stilit të jetesës së pacientit që fshihen prapas sëmundjes. Tre faktorët kryesorë që shkaktojnë stres tek një individ janë: humbja e një njeriu të afërt, ndryshimi i vendit të punës dhe ndryshimi i vendit ku banojmë. Mjeku sot, thot ai, nuk kalon më shumë se 10 minuta me një pacient. Në fakt, një mjek që takohet me pacient për vetëm 10 minuta, fiton 3 herë më shumë se të tjerët. Por në njëtën kohë, këta mjek, thot ai, nuk din se si të hetojnë shkakun e një sëmundjeje, nuk din se si ta kurojnë një pacient një herë për gjithmonë, sepse nuk din të bëjnë pyetjet e duhura, e për t'i bërë këto pyetje, mjeku duhet të kalojë më shumë kohë me pacientin, të lidhet me të, ta njohë atë. Në këtë mënyrë trajtohen pacientët në Institutin Kombëtar të Mjekësisë Integrative. Instituti merret dhe me hulumtime, të cilat po japin kontribut të rëndësishëm në mjekësinë integrative në rang botëror.
I was assisting the top heart surgeon at the Alfred. He did the first valve in this country, heart valve. And he was saying, I can't forget this word. He said, anatomy is where you find it. And I thought to myself, why did we spend all that time learning all that rubbish? And that's what you do in surgery. You don't just go slash. There's always variants. You can't even, you've got to have some idea as to where you are, you know, in other words, that you're in the leg or you're in the face. But that to spend all that time, it was just repressive behavior, learning all that detail that a month later or 3 weeks later, it's all gone. What sort of education is that? That's what we don't want in education. It's all in Google. I use the computer with virtually every patient I see.
Yes,
I introduce them to our website. We've got three meditation CDs there which can be accessed, but we put them together. They're amongst the top people in the world. Two for adults and one for children up to adolescents. Then I also search for things because there's always, I spend 20 to 40 hours reading a week. Unfortunately, very few doctors do regular reading. They're depending on going to one or two conferences which are basically funded by the drug industry. Now, if I'm a CEO of a $1 trillion drug company, who do you think I'm going to invite to speak? Someone who increases my sales or someone that decreases my sales? They're unlikely to invite someone like me because integrative medicine, which I've helped pioneer, is about the principles of it are to always be interested in all of the medicine that exists, not just prescription medicine, which we call it, which is about 98% of medicine now. But also the other medicines, but health medicine. And why did the person become unwell? That's a critical factor. And to just work on diagnosis and get on to writing out the prescriptions is bad medicine. And the public are recognizing this. And it's because of that that we've been able to set up one of the unique institutes in the world, the National Institute of Integrative Medicine, where we have a large integrative clinic, but we also are very, very active in research. And even though our research department is not big, we create some of the most unique medical research work in this world. And having been in the European Integrative Medical Conference, where our research was clearly the most outstanding type of work that's being done. And we're also working on the teaching, which will expand as we go along. We do have a presence in the Gold Coast as well. Mm-hmm. We would hope that we're national. We are supported, of course, by the educated public. They want proper medicine. Mm. And people are finding out. I was just seeing a cancer patient Thursday afternoon. She's early 40s, spread of cancer. But she was so knowledgeable. She's got four young kids, 6 to 9 year old, all young boys. And what I thought it was also, they came from South Africa and left there about 12 years ago, but they're in the UK before moving to Australia about 3 years ago. Now, that's a very, very dangerous environment to come from. Mm. Not only, see, the three top stresses, which were mainly put together in the 1960s by the, and I know the fellow who did that, but his name doesn't come to me at the moment, were loss of a close one, and the second and third vary a bit, loss of a job, change of home, or change of work. They're the top three big stresses in life. As to how they interpret it depends on the individual. If you're sensitive, you'll pick up things and worry a lot. And unfortunately, if you don't have people close to you, like someone within a mile or walking distance, to share your problems with, that is a critical factor. And I mentioned to you prior to our interview here that politicians, unfortunately, are amongst the least sensitive. We had one die recently, Tim Fisher. He was extraordinarily different. He was sensitive. So I wasn't surprised that he got cancer. That's the sort of person we expect to get cancer. Sensitive, a person who's caring. And he was very much so in that area. And unfortunately, we need more. Well, fortunately, we don't have enough of those kind of people that really care about their country and their people. And so the other thing about this person was that they're renting and the landlord won't let them have a little dog. Now, there's a truckload of research data to show that a little dog, or it can be a bigger dog, is profoundly supportive to children, but also is to the human who's got the cancer, because you turn up and they care about you, and this is what people need. Now, having been to all these different countries, like this patient I was talking about, she would have, look, generally you've got one or two or three close people that you can really share with, but if you move country, then you're really at risk because of the isolationism, which is now recognised as being the key factor to do with longevity, risk to longevity and illness and death.
And a continuous presence in Australia and an Australian lifestyle, I suppose, as well.
Oh, very much so.
Dhe si lindi ky pasion? Një pasion që u kthye në qëllimin e karrierës së tij. Si ndikoi kultura shqiptare në këtë formim?
What sparked your interest in integrative medicine?
Look, I get asked that question, but it wasn't as if I got hit by a bus one day. I was different, and now that I can see that, I was different from the beginning, you see. And having come from a different environment, I saw a different culture, I saw things differently. And as I must say that, this I got from a close friend of mine who said, well, if you're different, you're likely to make a difference. Sometimes it can make a bad difference, but most of the time, yeah, it's a good difference. And I was different, you see. And there are some people that all of a sudden see, meditation or something as being the answer to everything. With quite a few of them, I get very suspicious about what the real drive behind the scenes is. And is it really something to do with passion and that you're really driven by the fact that you want to do some good, or whether it's mainly orientated towards doing a lot of good for yourself? I find this, we've got son, daughter, son. And I have to say that once your children have gone through the primary school, they've virtually been converted to British culture. You know, and people worry about those Sudanese and whatever, but in general, once they've been through, because my wife is European from the mm-hmm. Czech Republic, a small country. In fact, prior to the Second World War, rated about the number one country in the world in virtually everything. Biggest music, second biggest in movie producing prior to the Second World War, but also reasonably close families. But our children certainly have got a predominance of British culture about them. Once they've been through, in particular, just that primary school, it has a huge effect. And trying to change cultures is a different thing. Now, I started as being one of the first people, certainly in this country, of having an interest in health, not just disease. Well, the disease, of course, makes money. Health doesn't make a lot of money. Mm. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, and they do their work better than anyone else. They're the masters of the capitalist system. And they, of course, are about illness, and that's where you make money. You don't make a lot of money from health. Health is about self-responsibility in a big way, but being taught as well. So the integrative medicine, of course, an important factor is health. But if we look at, say, a cancer patient, it's been shown very clearly that a healthy cancer patient will do much better than an unhealthy. So even if we don't have fancy things, which we do have, we do the sort of fancy things they do in Switzerland or Germany, but we do to start with, the basic principle is to make the person as healthy as possible. Look, sometimes you hear of a 40 or 50-year-old dying of the flu. Now, almost invariably, that person is not going to be a very healthy person. A healthy person does not die of the flu. It would have to be a very rare exception. So a 70-year-old is unlikely to die of the flu unless they're very unhealthy. So even with the flu, if we make the person healthy, then they also get protection from something like that. But unfortunately, it's only recently that people have taken the responsibility where they have become interested in health. And we see this demonstrated in television shows, in magazines, and that's the future. Integrative medicine will be basically the only medicine in the future.
Profesor Sali i zbaton të gjitha ato që thot. Djemt dhe vajza e tij jetojnë pranë tij. Në mëngjes, ato e viziton nipi dhe pasi kalon disa momente të çmuara me familjen, ai drejtohet për në institut. Fëmijët janë pasqyra e prindit dhe një prej djemve të tij është edhe një prej biznesmenëve më të njohur në Australi. I njohur si figura përgjegjëse për suksesin e markës së njohur të vitaminave australiane Swiss. Dërgjuesit tanë Australi dhe jashtë, ndoshta e dinë se Radek Sali ishte përgjegjës për rritjen e kësaj kompanie fillimisht të panjohur australiane dhe promovimin e vendit me anë të yjeve botërore si Ellen DeGeneres dhe Nicole Kidman. Më pas profesori merret me pacientët, me leksione, me takime e të tjerë. Ai thotë se lexon 20 deri në 40 orë në javë e mendon se leximi është çelësi i vetë edukimit.
So what does a typical day in Professor Avni Sali's life look like?
Well, the grandson comes in the mornings. Sometimes he comes quite early because I work until quite late because I'm usually reading the various medical articles. And fortunately, I can do them most often when there's a nice documentary on SBS television, which I say is just the most outstanding television station, running documentaries where I've actually learned so much. And he'll turn up, and we've had different things through his life. You see that he's three in a couple of weeks, but now we've got a building in the back, and we go out there in the back to chase monsters. So we're chasing monsters at the moment, and I'm GD, abbreviated for Granddad, mm-hmm. and that's really an exciting thing. But at work, ideally, but it's so difficult when you're running, you know, we've got over 120 or so people working in the one place, is to run a culture which I was so impressed to hear that Richard Branson, which my eldest son is very close with, he runs 440 companies, and he runs them on the principle of everyone but must be happy about coming to work, and hence they run themselves. And that's the big secret. That's what ideally I'm working on. It's a bit more complicated and complex with what we do, but that's what I am ideally working with. We try and have a cuppa break at 11 o'clock where people get together, you see, and the group people can talk about work issues or personal issues even, develop that connectivity. That's the ideal, but mm-hmm. it can be difficult. I do see patients only a day and a half a week because then I've got teaching, research responsibilities and administrative responsibilities. And at home, I'm virtually every night I would be less so on the weekend, but not during the day. On the weekend, I would catch up on mainly reading. When I said I do 20 to 40 hours reading a week in order to have some idea, you see, about what's happening. And unfortunately, unless you read in the medical world, if you just go to the drug conferences, you're going to get a biased type of education. But then we have get-togethers, and like this afternoon, we're having our granddaughter's first birthday party. And that should be really, she's very cute. She smiles at everyone. Grandchildren are absolutely another dimension. I never really realized, and it's really quite fascinating with the ABC. They are running this program, Old People's Homes for Four-Year-Olds. It's a huge program. Just finished. They did a repeat the other night, which I missed some of it because I was away overseas. And they showed in these elderly people who were very depressed, immobile, and they brought these four-year-olds in there. And they changed within 3 months. It changed the way they are. That'll revolutionise. But also it highlights this business of putting elderly people in a veggie patch somewhere. It's dreadful. There shouldn't be any such thing, old age homes. They should be incorporated as part of the village where we live. You see, big cities, car cities are monsters, and we've got the biggest monsters in the world per population of a developed country. How our politicians could allow this is ridiculous. Just fast trains would be a very, very important way. A 300-kilometre train per hour would make people go out in the country easily. There's lots of vested interest in why that doesn't happen, because I've had to understand all these political issues. It is wonderful what was in that program, that you can convert people that were virtually not moving, that they're actually not only moving, but they're moving quickly. And what's more, it was good for the children. Children that had problems with communication and social skills, they improved out of this world. You know what? That was put together by a professor of geriatrics in Sydney, and I forget her name now, but there's a person that can make a difference. Wonderful stuff.
We need more people like that, I think.
Yes,
we
do.
We need more people like you.
Yeah, well, yes, especially as I'm getting older, I dread the business of being put in a veggie patch somewhere.
Let's hope not.
Dhe planet për të ardhmen janë optimiste. Më shumë punë me veten, më shumë punë për të ecur përpara me pasionin e tij. Nëse ke një zakon të keq, puno me veten dhe ktheje në një zakon të mirë, thot profesor Sali për ne.
You know, I'm 78 now, and a birthday coming up pretty soon. And Rupert Murdoch, he's 88, last year he's getting married at 87. And people say, "Oh, stupid fool," to Jerry Hall, Mick Jagger's former wife. But I say to people, do you think he's getting married because he feels like an 87-year-old or that he may feel like a 37-year-old? I was fortunate actually to communicate with him when he had prostate cancer, and this was known in public because I can't talk about patients, but it was in the media. He had prostate cancer at 71. He was a very impressive patient. This is what he said to me. He said, "You tell me what I need to do about my health and I'll do it. If I've been doing the wrong thing for 71 years, it's about time I changed, because most of the things we do, they're just habits. So if you've got a bad habit, let's work on introducing a good habit." And look at this, not that we want everyone at 87 to be married again, but you know, it's because he is feeling so well more than anything else.
Is that you? Are you feeling well?
Yes, well, I've got the energy, and I work longer hours than virtually anyone in our building. And so even if I reduce my hours a little bit when I'm 100, I'll still be able to be there.
Spoken like a true Albanian, I'd say. It's been a pleasure having you here, Professor Sali. It's wonderful to see you again, and I wish you the best of luck and success in your future endeavours.
Thank you, and thank you for the wonderful work that you do here. It is about education, and that way we can make real changes.
Thank you.
Want to hear more stories like this? Subscribe to our regular podcasts on iTunes.